Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, where it's my job to introduce you to people from the world of commercial property. We're talking with investors and thought leaders about their experiences of the commercial property world and sharing our own lessons from the last 20 years to give you practical know-how so that you can follow in their footsteps. If you've ever thought commercial could be your next step, but it just seems too confusing and opaque, then you've come to the right place. There are so many exciting opportunities in this dynamic sector, and I'm looking forward to pulling back the curtain and sharing them with you.
Welcome to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, and I'm your host, Jerry Alexander. This show is all about commercial property investing for the private investor. Whether you're just getting started or scaling up your portfolio, through interviews, tips and lessons learned along the way, we want to give you the inspiration, knowledge and confidence to enjoy this great cash flowing strategy. Welcome to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast. Laurie, Alex, it's so good to see you. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
It's super to be watching. We were just talking before we came on here, just to watch your meteoric rise during COVID and this time when it's actually been really difficult to meet anybody. And we haven't, I mean, we know each other, right? We've been communicating for a while. Laurie, we've met once before, but it's just bizarre, isn't it? Now that we're starting to get out, we're actually allowed to meet each other. And going to networking events and actually seeing people for the first time, but you've known them for 2 years.
It's all these people that I feel like I really know, especially when I listen to your podcast and a lot of the other guys. You feel like you know them, but you've never physically met.
It's crazy, isn't it? But it's good. It's good. And I was out at a networking event last week and I met a bunch of people that I know from online, but there they were physically. And it's great to get out again and meet people. And of course, the thing is, you have those conversations eyeball to eyeball, and there's just that deeper understanding, a better connection, isn't there? There's just nothing quite like meeting people in the same room.
I think everybody's been like battling through during COVID, like trying to do business, trying to do these networking things on Zoom and stuff. But I was thinking about that just this morning. I think it's because you see more of these events happening now, you know, and it's just, in fact, I think I saw a post, somebody had put it up just being like, you know, getting a train, or I got the train yesterday, I went and had this meeting, we shook hands, we'd done a deal, we went for a beer, and then we went up the road, you know, and it was like, that's just cool, you know, that's how we do business. And it's good to see it getting back to normality these days.
Right, gents, thanks so much for joining me. So you guys have been on a couple of podcasts, and I've heard your story, right? And I think it's amazing what you've done in such a short period of time in residential. But I also know, which is maybe less talked about, that you guys are also doing commercial deals. So we're going to come on to that. But I think we should set the scene. Let's talk about your story so far with residential. It's part of your DNA. You've built a fantastic portfolio. So I think maybe if we just go back to the start, we'll quickly run through that, and then we'll talk about the commercial stuff. So I don't know which one of you wants to take this one, right? We'll do a tag team here. But basically, if you can just set the scene as to where you two came together and where you were at residential-wise, and then what happened after that discussion and you guys actually sort of started doing work together and then realised, you know what, we've got a formula here that can really work.
Aye, so back in 2018, I think it was, we were both kind of doing our own things. We were both kind of working in corporate lives, both having to travel a lot and all that kind of stuff, being away from home. And, you know, that kind of gig was cool when you were young and hip. But then as you got a bit older and your mobility started going, we're only 37, by the way. But, you know, it was kind of like, we really don't want to be doing this anymore. And we want to try and create something for ourselves. And we were always interested in property. Eck had the one buy-to-let. I had taken 9 years to build up 3 buy-to-lets just by sitting them and refinancing them as and when the mortgage term came round, you know. And but at that time, it was just after Clause 24 came in, and then we were thinking, like, maybe this is crap, maybe we don't want to do it. And we were talking about just selling off and then, I don't know, maybe paying bits of the mortgage down and whatever. But then just through us talking about things, we started talking a lot about strategy, sharing ideas and this type of thing. And it was quite cool. You know, there was just a clear kind of synergy there. At the time, Rood Group was not even on the radar. Ek was doing his stuff. I was doing my stuff. We sold these ones that we had, and then we started kind of buying some kind of cheaper low-end, high-yielding resi stock. And we were just sharing ideas, really. I think it got to about 2019, and we were just in contact all day, every day. At times it was like, hey, maybe we should do something together, you know? And so that's when we started Rood Group, and we started applying everything that we'd learned up until that point, and just being a bit more kind of serious about it. And then we'd created this idea for our business, you know, which was initially just residential buy-to-let. As you say, it's our DNA. Since then, you know, we've left our jobs. We left our jobs just at the tail end of last year. We were milking that to death. We've built up a portfolio now on the residential side of over 200 units. We've got over 100 in legals. And by the end of the year, we should be 300, 350 anyway on the resi buy, let's say. That's how we kind of started. But as you say, you know, we do have these other businesses where we've got developments, some commercial to residential conversions. We've got the training business, and we've got our own building company as well. So we've morphed into something quite different, really, all during the COVID period.
Yeah, amazing. And 300 units, that is a... As much as the challenge is finding properties and financing them and all that sort of stuff that everybody knows about, that is a step change in mindset. What was it that allowed you that headspace to actually make that decision that actually was believable to go after 300 units? Because, you know, we know people who've spent 10 years getting 10 properties, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, you said yourself, 9 years, three properties. What step change happened there? What made it believable?
I think, you know, we talk a lot about this word reality, and reality comes from where your perspective is on what's achievable, right? So we just started to think, okay, within the first year we were working together, we managed to get 40 properties together without really doing anything exceptional, just buying deals, finding investors, you know, doing the sort of daily grind of it. And, you know, we started to, and Laurie, of the two of us, is always the big ideas guy. You know, he's always the one that comes up with these radical targets of how would we do that? And then, you know, somewhere in the middle with my logical, rational mind, we'll hash out something that sort of makes sense. So, you know, that was exactly it. You know, he said, okay, well, we're at 40, that's great, but how do we get to 200? You know, what's the next step change to make that happen? And that's where we started looking at the portfolio acquisition. And around about that time, we'd done our first portfolio finance deal, and we kind of now classify this as two phases of property investment. You've got phase one of residential investment, where you're doing individual deals, you're dealing with individual lenders, they're very specific in their criteria, they don't like ex local authority, anything above a pub, blah, blah, blah. It's very difficult, very challenging, huge amounts of admin. But when you transition onto portfolio lending, it gets much more simple. It's a relationship you have with your lender. And we quickly realized that. Not only that, we realized that there was this strategy for acquiring portfolios. And it just so happened that about this time, a portfolio in Lanarkshire of 80 properties came across our desk, and it's like, we need to try and find a way to buy this. And through a lot of wheeling and dealing, and you know, we met them at this weird little leisure centre somewhere in Lanarkshire. And the guy just immediately said, 20% discount, that's your lot, pal. But if you can do that, then we've got a deal. So we agreed the deal then and there with no idea how we were going to buy. None whatsoever. And through the course of a lot of wheeling and dealing over the next sort of 2 to 3 months, we managed to find the finance. We managed to find a new commercial lender that would support us. And we managed to transition to what we call phase two, where you're buying and acquiring portfolios. And most importantly, you have this relationship with your lender, whether it's not a computer says no because they don't like the property or some specifics. They work with you to make things happen. And that's all we've done from then is replicate that model. We're still buying individual units, albeit on a bigger scale. You know, we're aiming for sort of 10 a month. And we're constantly refinancing and repackaging them. It's BRRR on a big scale, ultimately. But once you've learned the secrets of buying a portfolio and all the challenges that come with that, you know, you can scale massively, very quickly.
I think the biggest thing for me in that, and you said at the start of the podcast, Jerry, was the mindset. And we were talking about this just this morning in another meeting that we were having, but it was like, we have always been of the view, like, commit now, figure shit out, and achieve your goal. And as X says there, when we met this guy and we were like, okay, yeah, let's buy it. It's like, we just had to figure shit out. And we did that, and we keep doing that with all these other things we're getting involved in. I think that's a big deal. You know, people going, like, a lot of people think this, like, mindset thing is like a really hippie thing, you know, but it's so important to get your head right. And if you do that, it can lead you onto these kind of bigger things, I think.
Yeah. I want to dive a little bit into that finance side. I mean, there's lots of questions in there, but that finance side is really interesting. You talked there, Alex, about moving over to commercial lending, and that most people I talk to in residential, particularly if they're starting to look into commercial, their thought process is, I buy the property, I do it up. I mean, there's the standard format, right? I do it up, I rent it out, and then I'll refinance. And when I refinance, I'll go with the best deal. And they end up with this portfolio with multiple lenders. And it can be quite difficult when you're trying to make that transition into commercial and thinking, well, actually, hold on a minute, multiple lenders isn't necessarily a good thing in this space because I can't leverage the existing portfolio without having to offer security in different directions. And actually, in commercial in particular, if you've got a vehicle there, a limited company, whatever way you've set it up, when you pool all of that together, it gives you that opportunity, as you say, to raise finance in a slightly different way, not to be property specific, but by having security over the whole portfolio. It really is quite interesting how that works. But for you guys, because I think it's the Bank of Scotland you're with at the moment, isn't it?
We're with Redwood mostly. I mean, we're using a few lenders now, actually. We're big with Together as well. There's multiple options, but it's ultimately a commercial product that we're on.
Yeah. And when you went from using multiple lenders to that first lender that did the commercial, did you already have an established connection there? How did that come about? How did you meet the right person who actually said yes?
I think that was another thing back to the mindset thing. It was like, how are we going to do this? And we just kept, you know, we're scouring the internet ultimately, a lot of phone calls, a lot of Zoom calls, you know, who's going to support us and why, and all this kind of stuff. And it was really just I guess the research, you know, at that time, we had done our first portfolio finance deal with Bank of Scotland, and we were speaking to them, but that like when we moved into Bank of Scotland, that was when we stopped dealing with the likes of, you know, TMW and Paragon and Precise and all these kind of guys. You know, that was, I think we only had like, what, 13 units? Well, we had 13 units in that company to do that first portfolio deal. It was £1 million portfolio deal. Bank of Scotland gave us about 650 grand or something like that. But I continue to do this constantly. I'm constantly looking for new finance solutions, and it's a really interesting side of the business, I guess, because when we first started, going back to that 2018 when we were talking about it and thinking, oh, we're just going to get out of this because it closed 24, there was also no lenders in Scotland to buy stuff at like 50 grand 60 grand, you couldn't get loans. And that's another big difference with commercial lenders. Generally, they don't give a shit about, you know, concentricity or number of units in a block or all that kind of restrictive crap. And that's the biggest difference that we find with dealing with commercial lenders. You've just got a hell of a lot more flexibility. Now you'll pay for it. You know, you cover all their fees and you buy them dinner and all the rest of it. The interest rates are high. But in comparison to these other kind of like challenger bank type folk, you know, but the flexibility that it provides, it's necessary, as you say. You need to get away from these kind of what we call phase one lenders, if you want to scale to the kind of level that we are. We couldn't be operating now dealing with these types of guys.
Yeah, and that is a step change for people to make. But let's just dig in a little bit further. There is obviously the element the bank don't fund. There's the private finance element. So let's just talk about that for a second. When you were looking at that big portfolio of 80, relatively big, maybe that's going to be small soon for you guys, right? But you're looking at that portfolio and you're thinking, right, well, maybe we can get bank finance, but we appreciate we still need to find 30%, 40%, whatever it is. Let's just talk through that a little bit. Did you find multiple investors? How did you go about that process?
So I think the first thing to understand is there are exceptional products out there that a lot of people don't know exist. And these are not products that you're going to get offered the first day you walk in the bank, but by developing a relationship, you can get some amazing products. And on that particular deal, we leveraged a 90% loan against purchase price because it was in the parameters of 70% of aggregate market value. Yep. You know, we have aggregate market value, 20, we got a 20% discount on it. we got 90% of that purchase price because it was still within the 70% LTV of aggregate market value. Now, most banks won't give you that. You won't get that. So we've now got a situation where instead of having to find 30% of the cash we need to purchase it, we only need to find 10%. So that massively reduced the amount of cash we had to put in, albeit we had to put in some front-end cash. The front-end costs in a portfolio acquisition are much higher because lawyers want money up front. There's going to be a lot of survey costs. In that instance, we had to do a lot of compliance stuff as well because some of the properties weren't compliant. So there's more risk on the front end, but albeit less cash overall. And in that deal, we used joint venture finance. So you know, 50-50 joint ventures. We brought the deal. They brought the funds, albeit, you know, limited funds. And that's how we've done it. Now, the deals that we're doing now are structured slightly differently, and we're probably moved away from that model. But, you know, we're now on a bridge finance products where we can do a big BRRR, and they're giving us 85% of purchase price on a bridge, you know.
Even 90% in some occasions as well. Yeah.
But, you know, again, that's because we've built a relationship. We've done this many times, and they know they can trust us to exit, etc. So
exactly. So for those listening thinking, right, that's the product for me, you got to work your way up to it. But equally, the positive about all this is that those are possible. You just have to know it's a part of a process, isn't it? You've got to do the steps. I remember as we were doing our commercial portfolio, each building, we'd push the envelope a little bit. It'd maybe be first one's full, the next one's maybe partly occupied, the next one's empty, the next one's, you know, got no income at all. It's got some liabilities, and potentially you might do some residential things. So each time you're pushing the envelope, but the risk becomes less for the lender because your experience has got better, you've got a wider portfolio and all that sort of stuff. So you can scale up to these things. It's just knowing that they're available, isn't it?
Yeah, like we get people approaching us now all the time, you know, looking to kind of get our finance business ultimately, you know, because we've got the credibility, we've got the story, we're all over social media, you know, so folks see what we're doing and they kind of want a piece of the pie. But again, that as you say, comes with experience, comes with actually doing the work, and the more kind of credibility you demonstrate, you know, the more flexible these funding options can become, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Right, so I'm going to touch on one other thing before we dive into some of the commercial stuff. Partnership. So you guys have got different backgrounds. Alex, your skill set is accountancy, numbers, really making sure that things work. Laurie, you've more visionary, and to me that sounds like a great combination. So, you know, you've got somebody there pushing and somebody keeping the feet on the ground so that this actually works out. What else would you put down for your success? Because you guys have been working together for obviously a number of years, and, you know, let's be fair, there's definitely been some challenges in there, right? This has not just been an easy process. So what sort of things that, you know, do you know each other's strengths? Do you sometimes know when to back off? Do you know when to push? You know, there's all these things.
I always need to back off.
It's incredible how well we know each other's reactions now, you know, after so long. I mean, as you say, it's just a really good balance between the two of us. And I've been taught over the last few years to never say no, but only say yes, but, you know, there's always a but, you know, the fundamental start is always like, right, how do we make this happen? You know, and everything with Laurie and I has always been organic, right? We never sat down and said, let's go into business together. It just organically happened over time. We naturally gravitated towards it. And, you know, that's why it's worked so well. You know, we always solve solutions together, a huge amount of respect for each other. And I don't think, you know, we've never had an argument. You know, we've always solved any issues. And it's not like we don't always see things from the same perspective, but we do always kind of meet somewhere in the middle when it's necessary.
And Laurie, for you, have you found being the person that's maybe pushing a little bit more sometimes, have you learned when to back off a little bit? Or is it more Alex that's learned to deal with you? how would you view that?
It's maybe like a mix, because I think the biggest, I'm always going to be the radical idea guy, but ultimately we've got the same objective, right? And we're just kind of trying to get there. So it is about this kind of problem solving thing, and there's never anything that we like can't discuss or whatever. It's just like, is this too crazy or not? You know, we've got Connor Tracy who works with us as well. Now he's our head of group development, and he brings another personality and another mind into the mix. We've also got James on the technical, the architectural technician side. Now he's in house, and Nick as well on the building code. And see, when we're all, because it's not just me and Alex that's talking about things now, right? I mean, when we had a meeting yesterday about a really interesting, I guess, commercial project here. And there was the four of us, me, Connor and James. And we just went and sat and had a blether after kind of going and doing this viewing. And the ideas that come out are just the different minds bouncing ideas off. It's just awesome. And it was the same for us in the early stages. It was kind of like, you know, how can we do this? Don't know. Can we try and figure it out together? Yeah, there's sometimes things that require, I guess, a bit more, a bit longer of a chat, like, you know, because it's not always kind of easy to achieve these things that we're going after. But I think it's just the respect from each other to be open to the other's mind. And that's, I think, what, you know, that those conversations combined is what creates the success for me.
Do you sometimes have to find your, because I've worked with partners in the past and had some really, really good partnerships and some that have been less so. But do you find sometimes you just need to plant that seed and let it germinate for a little while? Maybe an idea, something you think is maybe important, but you realize that this one might be a challenge to get across. You just got to plant that seed and start working on it? Or do you like to just get out in the open and discuss it straight away?
No, we are super direct, super direct. Everything's discussed around the table and nothing's off the table. So, you know, Laurie will sometimes float an idea, which I initially hate, but by the end of the conversation, you know, I'm on board, you know, so it's just that's just how it works.
Great. Okay, thanks for that. Right, so commercial and development. Let's open that wider, right? Because obviously you guys are looking at doing development and commercial to resi. Let's just talk about some of the deals that you've been doing and maybe some of the outcomes that have happened so far. So, Alex, Laurie, do you want to take us through that journey?
I mean, we've probably not got many outcomes to talk about on the development side because we've had, I mean, I think we bought our first development a couple of years ago. That was the Poundies one that Ek mentioned. That is only just, okay, we've got planning on it and we've got 30 grand a year coming in for Poundies and that. So that's a decent, like, you know, acquisition in the end. We were paying us nothing. But we got planning permission after about maybe a year, 18 months or something like that. And we've just kind of been sitting on this building. It's a 2,500 square metre commercial building, shops on the bottom floor, empty space on the top. And we're putting another level on the top to create 23 units for resale. We're only just looking to start a bit of demo, a bit of preliminary kind of stuff in that project now. So not much to kind of report on that, but that should be a very interesting project, 3.6 million GDV, probably a couple of years before we kind of finish that. It's a longer term thing. But the Temperance House development is a very cool development, and that's well underway now. You know, another kind of few months, 3-4 months, we should be finished. We're expecting sales before the end of the year. That's a 900k GDV development over 6 flats, and I guess they're our commercial to residential conversion projects. You know, we do have, you know, we've just concluded on our first actual, and I put a post up about this morning actually about the first kind of single resi unit flip, which is like a 4-bed house we're kind of extending and converting. For resale, it actually came with 12 and a half acres of land, which is another story. But we've got our challenges around how we kind of deal with that land because of some title issues. And then we've got the South Bells Dyke project, which is a farmhouse extension and conversion, plus planning already in place for 5 units, but we're going to change it to 7. And then we've got another bit of land that we're going to put another 5 on, hopefully. But these are like recent acquisitions. And yeah, it'll be a bit further down the line before we have the results, unfortunately, you know. Albeit that the Pennycook one will only be like 6 months or something.
Just to tack on one more project, it's our first completed project, commercial, truly commercial resi, was the 60B LaPorte Precinct, which is a 10-bed HMO. So that was a restaurant we converted into a 10-bed HMO last year. finished, and that's been you know, in terms of the numbers, albeit occupancy is a bit up and down, the returns on that are phenomenal.
Now that you mentioned that, we did have a more gradual scale. We didn't just go in and buy this big 2,500 square meter building as our first kind of gig. That was our first bigger development. But the very first one we did, and it was, you know, it was like above this Domino's thing. It was an old council office, so it was classed as an office, but the place was a wreck. We converted that into a 6-bedroom HMO. And then, yeah, we did the 60B one, which was an old Indian restaurant. We converted that into a 10-bedroom HMO. So there has been a gradual scale, you know. But they're currently held in our resi buy-to-let portfolio, you know, so I don't really think about them as commercial development projects, but they were, really, yeah.
Yeah, so you had to go through the process of buying a commercial property. But let's just quickly rewind, Laurie, because we had a conversation before we went online here or on air. So just a little bit more context about the larger property, the 2,500 square meter, did you say? Yeah, so 26,000 square foot. When you bought it, it had some backstory. It had already been bought and sold before and had a high ticket price. You guys bought it at a lower price, but there was no income. Let's just talk through that, because there was no commercial income, but there was a tenant. So just talk through those numbers.
So, I mean, this one was really interesting. It was something that was on our radar for about probably 8 months before we eventually done a deal on it. But, you know, the idea for Laurie and I at the time was, there has to be some good money in conversion on the high street, right? So you've got all these empty units, you know, kind of death of the high street. Falkirk town centre is particularly bad. And us being local boys, we thought we'd start there. So we literally went up and down the high street with a clipboard, looking at all the unused commercial space above, found out who owned it. And over the process of the next couple of years, we bought 4 properties in the high street. But this one was the first one, 150 to 156 High Street, the Poundies building, as we call it, because Pound Stretchers are on the ground floor. Their unit is about 1,000 square metres, so a really big unit right on the High Street. They were on a peppercorn rent, I think it was maybe a quid a year when we took it on. It is a listed building, so I'm not really sure why that was the case, because, you know, obviously the tenant leaves. And as it's a listed building, you don't have to pay rates as the landlord. You would have some utilities and maintenance. So, you know, there was a marginal advantage to keeping Pound Stretchers in there on basically nil rent. But that's how we bought it. The previous owners had spent $2.3 million on that building. And I think that was a time where Pound Stretchers were paying maybe $140,000 a year in rent. So we managed to get them down over the course of 6 months, or more specifically, Laurie did, to $200,000. And it was not subject to VAT. It hadn't been opted to tax, so there was no VAT to pay. It was just a straight 200K acquisition. And you got 2,500 square metres of current building, you know, just huge opportunity for development. We had a few battles with Pound Stretchers over the year that we owned it. We threatened to kick them out in year two, if they weren't willing to agree to some sort of rent proposal. And because of COVID and the fact that they weren't having to pay rates at that point, they were in a position to pay us rent. And they agreed a 2-year deal where they pay us $30,000 a year for the next couple of years. So you know, we've turned that into a, you know, a justifiable investment just on the basis of the tenant. That's not to mention the second commercial unit on the ground floor that's currently still empty. And we need to keep that empty because there's some reconfiguration to be done for the development above.
Yes,
and then all this free space above, you know, 1,500 square metres of development space, plus the option to add on another level to the commercial extension at the back, which is already, you know, as you probably know, a lot of these commercial extensions are rated for much more weight than you would need for residential. So it's easy to add an extra level when you're talking about, you know, a timber frame extension for residential. So, you know, it's an exciting opportunity now.
Yeah. And it's interesting just to take a pause and just reflect on the fact that, you know, that's not something that you do tomorrow. You see it tomorrow, you buy it next Friday, and in 6 months' time you're out. These are commitments. And I appreciate, you know, the numbers that you managed to get that for are fantastic, right? But it's still a commitment, and it's a 2-year process. We're still in that process, but the rewards can be really good. And I think some people just forget that, you know, sometimes you just got to have that commitment, don't you, to just see these things through.
We're getting more and more. And I mean, look, you know, residential is our bread and butter, right? I mean, we'll never stop buying residential. It just works. We get it. We love it. But we've been getting more and more into kind of bigger developments now, you know, and we've got some stuff that we have not concluded on yet, but we're working away on in the background. And they are very, you know, just large scale stuff, as you say, longer term commitments, but much bigger returns. And, you know, it's nice to have that as part of the group because, you know, the buy to let stuff's great. You know, it pays you a couple of hundred quid a month cash flow. You've got that coming in and, you know, you don't really need to do much. And that's why we like it so much, because it allows us to free up our time to focus on all these other things, you know. It's just a nice blend, you know. I think it's a diversification we were always keen to have. And the more we get involved and looking for these other types of projects, you know, the bigger they seem to get. And we're definitely committed, yeah.
Good. I mean, they don't all turn into gold, right? I mean, there's a couple there, I think, along the way that you've had to reevaluate because of there's been so much disruption, hasn't there, in the last 2 years, which has brought loads of opportunity, but it's also brought some pain. So just talk us through, has there been a couple ones there that have maybe you've had to move on?
Yeah, there was four that we bought. And in fact, unfortunately, the two that we had to push on are some of the most stunning buildings in Falkirk High Street. You know, all four projects were listed buildings, but particularly the Burton's building that we bought, it only had the possibility to create three flats on the upper levels and two smaller commercial units. And given the level of work that needed to reinstate that listed building, you know, and all of the requirements that the council are pushing on you with, you know, stone repair and reinstatement and you know, sash and case windows that are, you know, fully glazed and acoustic glazing and blah, blah, blah. The costs just escalate to a point where the economics just don't stack up. And we went through the process. You know, we thought we could drive it down. There was apparently going to be some grants available from the council for some of the external work. They lost that money. So, you know, throughout a period of evaluation, we just felt, you know, it was maybe at best going to break even, and that wasn't a good way to use our time just now, given the amount of, you know, how stretched our resources are at the best of times. So, you know, we had to ditch that. The other thing to note, obviously, is that material prices have gone up exponentially, and you're talking in a situation that is combined. So take for example, you know, your average piece of timber has maybe doubled in price over the last little while. So when we first evaluated these projects, the costs had gone up exponentially for materials. You combine that with these new building standards that come in, where you're putting in misting systems, which in and of themselves maybe don't cost that much, but when you think about all the extra costs of running them, making sure they're fire insulated and protected and all that sort of stuff, the cost, you know, dramatically increases. And then another one that I got told that shocked me was after Grenfell, you know, Gyprock had this 30-minute fire rating on it, which they were no longer willing to stand by because over the course of years, their product had been degraded to save money. Then all of a sudden, we're in a situation where we're having to double sheet walls to get this 30-minute fire requirement because the product isn't as it was before.
Yeah.
And that's just doubled your cost immediately on that one thing. So, you know, there was all of these different elements that led to a situation where unless you're doing a commercial resi project, particularly in these listed buildings, they've got really tasty margins, then, you know, it's a challenge in this environment to do it. And we're fortunate enough that Temperance House, stunning listed building, oak staircase, it's got a huge amount of historical value, this building. Economics still really made sense on that project. The poundies, because we got that building so cheap, it's such a big space. It's predominantly empty commercial space, so the demolition is going to be pretty cheap. You know, again, the economics stack up on that one, although we have had vastly different estimations by four different quantity surveyors on what it might cost to develop that. But we're comfortable. We've got to an answer now that we can make work. So, you know, these are not projects for the faint-hearted, but there are big wins in there if you pick the buildings right.
Yeah.
The downside of that is we sold Burton's for 10 grand more than what we bought it for because we got it cheap. So if you're buying right, you know, even in the worst case scenario, we didn't really lose any money on that deal. Okay, maybe a few grand in architect fees here and there, but you know, nothing serious.
Yeah, your plan B, C, and D maybe don't work out, but plan E, resale, still make some money. Yeah, good. How did you find the buying process then for buying the commercial compared to the residential? How did you find that differed? As an example, you spoke there briefly about opted to tax. The building wasn't opted to tax, the larger one, which allowed you to not have to pay out the VAT at that stage. What else has been different in the buying process?
Well, that was a massive learning experience. Yeah, I mean, I think, what do you pay about 500 quid for a resi conclusion? You pay about $5,000 for a commercial project, you know. There were so many different things that come up there. The tax thing was new to me, didn't understand it. And in fact, it wasn't applicable in the end on the Poundies purchase. VAT was applicable on the Temperance House project. And at that time, the seller had the shop and the upper floor space all on the one title. So we had to split it off create clear securities for both lenders at that time. And we had to apportion, and Alex is the accountant, so he'll keep me right if I'm making an arse of these figures here. But it was like we ended up having to pay 10 grand. We split the purchase. It was a 250K acquisition. We allocated 200 grand to the cost of the shop, and then we allocated 50 grand to the cost of the upper floor space. But we brought in a private investor at 100 grand with security against the upper floor space as we split the title during the purchase. I think we used cash on the other, on that shop, but then we refinanced it onto a Shawbrook product term loan thing and got like 160 grand back or something like that. But VAT wasn't applicable on the shop, but it was only applicable on the upper floor space. Am I right? And then we reclaimed it from the upper floor space.
That's because of transfer of going concern, right? So we were able to apply TOGC to the shop because it was a tenant, it was paying rent, so we managed to get exemption on that. Because the upper floors were empty, we weren't able to do the same there, so we ended up having to pay VAT on that apportionment of the thing. But you know, it's a really interesting strategy that of having a commercial asset below that's generating cash and has an income, so you can get a loan against someone like Shawbrook for that. I think we got 160 grand on it. And then you can bring in a private investor on the empty space with a bit more flexibility. And ultimately, through those two things, we more or less financed that entire acquisition. You know, we didn't put any cash in, which meant we had the cash to then work through planning, work through initial stages of development, etc. So, you know, that was a cool thing with that project.
It's really interesting. So with what you learned on each of these projects, obviously you're building up more knowledge. You can start to look at deals in different ways. What are some of the things you're going to take on to the next one that you've learned on the last couple of acquisitions? Well, I mean, I'm sure there's quite a number of things there, but for listeners that are thinking about getting started and that sort of stuff, you've obviously picked up a few things. What are some of the nuggets that you would share on that?
One of the biggest eye-openers for me, like when we took on these projects, we were so naive. I did not appreciate the amount of shite that needs to get taken out of these buildings. Yeah. And I mean, you rip one panel off, you find another problem, you remove that problem, you find another problem. And Christ, that you should see the amount of stuff that's come out of the Temperance House development. And I mean, it's not that big. It's like 500 square metres or something like that. But also, you know, we couldn't get permits for skips and stuff. So the guys have had to go up with the vans and they've like been, you know, bagging up all the rubble, and they're having to go up and down the stairs. There's three flights of stairs with these bags of rubble. They took 300 bags of rubble out of that space just last week. And I mean, they've been constantly emptying this stuff. And it's just unbelievable to get it kind of back to the stage to allow you to start building. There's so much work involved, you know? And I think also when we acquired, we never had Rood Building Co. that we have now, right? We've got about 30 guys working for us now, and we have like this degree of flexibility. You know, we do maintenance on the buy-to-let side, we do the resi refurbs, and we do the developments. You know, we've got labourers to deal with the kind of rubbish and stuff. But that's allowed us to like keep all these things going. Like, I mean, if I was to go back and do that again, and if people are looking for golden nuggets, it's like, think about your builder, think about your time scale, think about, like, are they going to be committed to this? Are they going to really see it through? Are they going to provide this flexibility to you? Because if I think, like, if we didn't have Rude Building Co and we were planning on using just an external contractor to be doing this stuff for us, I mean, I just do not know how we would be getting on right now. Because, like, there's just so many complications. We've had guys, like, just dedicated to the development, just up there working every day, and that's what they do. But if it wasn't our own guys, I think that would have been a massive challenge.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody I'm working with yesterday who's started to scale the commercial portfolio, and I was talking about our square meter rates that we managed to achieve when doing refurb. And the question back was, how are you managing to do that? Because in residential, it's two or three times that for me or whatever it is. And I reflect on it for a little bit. And what you just described there is one of the key things. It's not having a management contractor for that particular element of what we're doing. And also, because I like, I'm one of those people who, I'm afraid, likes to see the layers come back and work out the design as we go along, which is not, I know, the perfect way of doing things, right? But it does allow, particularly those historical buildings, to make sure that you bring out the absolute best parts that you maybe didn't even know were there until you start peeling off all those layers and filling the skips, right? So, but the thing is, you don't have change orders. You don't have those extras that suddenly start adding margin for the main contractor onto the project and your costs go up. Sometimes it's a bit more chaotic, a little bit more chaotic, because your guys, as you say, they're coming in, they're doing different jobs. You're trying to make sure everybody's filling up their hours and not and being efficient. And so you might not always get things done at the right time. You might not always get things done on each project as sequentially as you would like, because there's other priorities pop up. But ultimately, that trades off at a much lower cost. And that, over the long term, helps you really save money, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the Temperance project is, well, it's not as chaotic as it kind of once was. Maybe a few months ago, it was very chaotic, you know. But it's kind of, there's a few rooms being framed out now, and there's different things of having kind of bigger scopes of work that have been done. And that's starting to kind of take shape now. But I mean, you know, there's also the funding that has to go along with that. And, you know, we've you know, within the group now, we have different cash moving around all the time on a big scale now. Alex keeps control of all of that. And back to the whole partnership thing that you talked about at the start, you know, I can't do that. I don't know how to do that. You know, he's the money man. He's the accounting guy. And we would not be doing what we are to the scale that we are if he wasn't controlling the cash the way he does. And he just thinks about it like a, you know, a big corporate accountant, whereas I need to, like, go, oh no, that goes there, and that goes, you know. But we've not got any development finance on that project, right? It's just it's just been funded privately so far, and you know, we need to pay the guys every week. There is that ongoing cost. The returns don't come until the sales happen, right, which is going to be towards the end of the year. So there's all these different considerations that I just don't think I had an appreciation for back when we acquired.
So let's just fast forward a little bit here. We've been talking about the resi portfolio. You're up to 300. I know you've got ambitions to get up to, well, last time I heard it's up to 1,000, but maybe you're scaling beyond that in your mind. But in terms of commercial, we've been talking about development, conversion to resi, some of that for resale, some of that I assume you're going to hold.
I think the majority of it's for resale, because we're talking about higher end assets. Right. If there's an angle to keep it, then we'd prefer to do that, because we just like to build a residence. But the yields have to be right. And when you're newer properties, you know, you are getting that premium for them, and it's unlikely that yield's going to make sense.
Yeah, the opportunity cost is high. Yeah.
So for us, we'd rather get that cash into the group and push it on to do better things, or to invest in assets that do fit our criteria. So no, we'll be selling it on. We are going to be heavily focused on new build developments going forward, just because of the opportunities that are coming over our desk just now, and the fact that we have had our challenges with some of the commercial residential stuff. Albeit, you know, commercial residential is definitely not off the cards. We like the HMO strategy, and, you know, where you can get big old spaces very cheaply and convert them without significant cost. You know, I think we ended up somewhere in the region of about 700 quid a square meter for conversion of the restaurant to a 10-bed HMO at Laporte Precinct. Now, when you put that into perspective, we're about 260 grand overall between the purchase, the development, etc. That, when it's full, brings in 8 grand a month of rent. Yeah. And we have very little cost because it's normally a company that takes out for a period of time. So, you know, you're talking 600 quid a month on mortgage and 8 grand coming in. The cash flow is insane on that stuff. You know, so we're definitely looking at more of that sort of thing. But I think that's where our commercial resi strategy is likely to focus. We do hold some commercial assets long-term that are rented, like, you know, we've got cash converters, we've got poundies, you know, those are rented, those are solid, you know, it's a good income, we'll continue to do that. We've always got our SaaS money in place, so we're always looking at commercial opportunities there. But I think for development, certainly in the medium term, we're very much focused on new build land development.
Yeah. And do you see your commercial for renting something that you're going to do more of, or just as a consequence of doing deals at a commercial to res and you end up with a commercial unit that maybe makes sense to hold on to? Or are you actually going to focus in on, you know, we're going to actually build up our cash flow through commercial assets as well?
We've toyed with that a little bit. And yeah, I mean, ultimately, the only reason we have some retail stuff is because it's consequential, right? I mean, we were forced to buy the whole building. You know, the seller wouldn't sell off the portion that we wanted to buy. That said, that's another golden nugget, if you like. I mean, if we had bought just the upper floor space, I mean, there's no way we could be doing what we are because we need the consent of the seller and all this kind of stuff. You know, it would have been a mess. So definitely important to do that. But I don't know. I think we did talk about starting like Rood Commercial or something like that. But I don't know. I think at the end of the Temperance project, if there's money coming in for cash converters, we might keep it, but, you know, we'll maybe just kind of sell it off and kind of be done with that. On the Poundies one, again, it'll just depend. I mean, it's a massive big shop, that. I mean, you can see real potential in that store for like a kind of one of these wee Tesco minis or a Co-op, what'd you call it? Superstore thing. You know, there's bigger, better tenants, I think, we can get in there. But, you know, Poundies are paying 30 grand a year. So that's like a good solid rent, especially in today's kind of market, you know, and we'll just see. I think we're open-minded about that.
Yeah, okay. And any final tips for anyone who's thinking about scaling up? So a little bit back to where you guys were earlier in that process, because we touched on a few things that helped to change for you, but anything you would just, extras you would suggest to people that are thinking, I really need to be scaling here and I don't quite know how to?
Get educated. I mean, that's the number one thing. I mean, we were able to fast forward, but we went through a painful process of learning how to, you know, buy portfolios and, you know, figured it out on our first deal ultimately. But, you know, first starts from getting the mindset right, thinking differently, pushing yourself out your comfort zone, because, you know, the knowledge alone isn't going to push you forward. There's so many people that kind of done the course, they know what they need to do, but yet they still don't take the action they need to because they've not got the mindset right fundamentally. And it kind of, as Laurie says, a lot of people see that as hippie. It's always how we start any training course when we do it is, you know, mindset has to be right first and everything else follows. So don't skip past that bit for sure. And learn how to do it. And if you can get a mentor that is, you know, been down the trodden path, it is hugely valuable. You know, we were really struggling in the early, you know, and that's why Laurie and I were so close, because, you know, he'd found out a little nugget and he was sharing it with me and I'd maybe found out something. And, you know, but we had to work pretty hard to get the knowledge that we acquired over those years, where, you know, if we just found the right mentor, we could have massively accelerated the process. And you say we're quick, but, you know, it could have been quicker if we'd known what we were doing earlier. And skipped a few of those mistakes. So, you know, leverage anybody you can really to help you accelerate your journey.
I think for me as well, a couple of things. One is SaaS. I think we kind of touched on it a couple of times through the conversation. You know, if you're into this kind of stuff, get a SaaS. You know, like, it's massively advantageous. So for anyone that doesn't know what it is, check it out, SSAS, Small Self-Administered Schemes, Pension Fund, blah, blah, blah. The other thing is our corporate structure now. I think that the way we are structured, you know, we've got our main holding co, We've got the investment stuff under that holding co. We've then got a separate holding co under the original holding co, which is just for trading activity. And within that trading holding co, there are, you know, various trading businesses, the building company, the developments business, the training company, and, you know, there will be some other SPVs in there as we move forward. You know, you were asking if we were going to keep some of the commercial conversion resi stock that we create. Generally, no, but we are looking at build to rent as another strategy for us moving forward. And by having that corporate structure set up correctly, there's just massive flexibility, massive tax advantages to you know, bringing all these things together. So definitely seek counsel on that. Everybody's got a different setup, but I love the way we are structured now. It makes so much sense. And ultimately, yeah, we've paid a lot for it for, you know, consultancy through our accountants and lawyers and all that kind of thing. But it's very, very cool. And if anybody wants to see our corporate structure chart, just let us know and we'll send it over to you.
Great, thanks. And we're just going to round this off because you've introduced this side. As one grows in these things, consultancy inevitably you get asked, could you help? What do you think? How does this? Can I pass this by? Just have a look. Give us your thoughts. So you guys have got a consultancy side now. So let's just briefly talk about that too. You've been helping and supporting other budding developers. Just what is it that you're focusing in on?
So at the moment, I mean, Laurie and I started looking at this over a year ago now. It's almost a year and a half we've been running with the training side of our business. But, you know, ultimately we wanted to create some products that we wish were available to us when we started this. I mentioned earlier, you know, it was a real slog trying to figure this stuff out. And I felt like, you know, there was a better way to learn where we could really help accelerate people's journey through this. And so we've got, at the moment, two core things that we do through that business. One is our introduction to property, which is a really broad view of property investment and what it can do for you. And we cover things like tax as well, because I think in this environment it's really important, and a lot of people shy away from it because it's specialist. But, you know, there's been a massive run on property investors over the last 5 years, 6 years, on tax. So you need to understand at least a fundamental level of that, all the different strategies you can do in property, etc. That's just an online course. It's £99 plus VAT, really cheap. But we do that really just to get people a good start in property and understand the fundamental things they need to know getting into it. So that was a product we really wished was available for us at the start. And the second thing we do, which is a more advanced training, that's one-to-one in Rood HQ, where we've got a training room. We do buy-to-let at massive scale. So that's our Rood Pro event, where, you know, it's a higher ticket event, but we work through with a selected group of people. We do it every 2 or 3 months. There's usually only about 15 people in the room max, and we teach them the strategies that have led to us having, you know, well over 200 properties. A lot of this stuff that I've talked about, like the phase one, phase two, how to do the finance in phase two with portfolio acquisitions, how to find the deals, etc., etc. And we actually help them with a bit of sourcing of deals on the back end once they come out. So we work with them for 90 days after. So that's really cool. I mean, there's nothing better than getting to work with people, you know, that are just starting out or have maybe been on it but started to get frustrated because they're stuck in phase one, yep, dealing with all these individual lenders. You know, we've been there, you know, and that's ultimately why we created this stuff to yep, try and help people.
And, you know, I found, because obviously I do similar stuff, and it forces you to think through the processes you've done, to articulate it well, and to build kind of models that explain it. You've got it in your head. Yeah. This process, right? And you're talking about their phase one, phase two, and these things. And these are kind of models that you develop to try and make it much more simple and understandable for people. And I found going through that process has really helped me reflect on my own business and improve things that we do on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. Have you found the same?
I'm laughing just now because we were in Temperance House just yesterday. And that's where Laurie and I put this model together for buy-to-let at scale. And he goes up every time he goes into Temperance House because there's still these two pins on the wall where we hung the whiteboard, because that was originally our office in Temperance right. House. He still goes up to it every time and gives them a little tap. You know, that's kind of where we started, you know.
Sorry. But it's funny to think back about that as well, because that's kind of where it started, and then that's where we came up with all the different kind of topics, the way we were going to do the trainings and stuff. And I mean, at the time, you know, because sourcing is now a big part of our business for our training clients. You know, they come and learn how to do it, but then everybody complains, you know, there's no deals. So that's Connor's background. You know, he's a deal sourcer extraordinaire. And so that's something else that we kind of bring to the table, because a lot of people struggle to find the opportunities now. You know, it seems like they've got the knowledge, they're ready to implement it, but they can't find something to buy. So we feed the opportunities into our training clients as part of that side of the business as well, which is cool. It's great to see. So many people are doing so well out of that. You know, I think we've traded about 15 deals just for the start of the year. And you see guys coming out the traps, flying, applying everything that we've taught, and they're achieving way beyond what they thought they could, you know, which is cool. Great to see.
Yeah, it can be. You mentioned earlier on, Alex, about people learning but not necessarily applying. So you might as well not bother even knowing it in the first place, right? and sometimes you think, well, what trigger can I work on here to help these guys get past that inertia? And it can be tricky, can't it? And for everybody, it's different. Some people, it's just actually being in a room with others that are getting on with it and they fear of missing out. Sometimes they're in a comfy position in life that actually they're not willing to do the pain. So, you know, you have these conversations, don't you, right, about how are we going to help these guys get over that? But at the end of the day, you've just got to keep providing the quality information, the stuff there, so that the tools are there when they're ready, they can go to it. And sometimes they don't do it straight away, do they? Sometimes it's a bit more of a slow burn, which may be frustrating for you, but ultimately, you know, that's the pace that they work at.
We actually Connor did this really cool thing with our last training course when we did it. We had a few live deals available and we thought, well, how about presenting them to the room after we've been through the training and all that on the sort of last day? We presented a couple of deals and it was a deal or no deal game where you say, okay, is this a deal or is it not a deal? Hands up, you know, and then you reveal afterwards, well, this is an available deal, guys. Who's going to take the action? And it really forces people to think how ready they are to move, you know, because, you know, go and see Connor at the end. He was there.
It was funny, though, because it was like, right, hands up, who would buy this deal? And everybody's like, yeah. And it's like, well, it's a live deal, so you want to buy it? And they're like, oh.
Now you're playing with them. Right, gents, where can people find out information about what you're up to and also about your consultancy side as well? What's the best places to find you?
I think the first thing to say is that, you know, we're very active on social media, mainly Facebook, LinkedIn and Instagram. So connect with us personally and drop us a message to let us know who you are and stuff, because, you know, we get all these invitations for folk on a global basis to connect with us and we have no idea who we are. We have no idea who they are. So, like, you know, drop us a message and let us know what the connection is and we will gladly connect with
you. That's right.
We've got two main websites. One is RUDGroup.co.uk. So RUD Group is R-E-W-D, which stands for Real Estate Wealth Development. So it's RUDGroup.co.uk for our general group-based website. And then there's a specific website for the training services as well, which is RUDTraining.co.uk. They both link to each other anyway. So, you know, they should be able to contact us via one of these channels.
Fantastic. Gents, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing so much information there. There's lots of little nuggets in there for people to take away and just the inspiration that you, if you put your mind to it and you work at it and you work on your mind, you can achieve loads. So thanks, guys, for joining us.
Absolutely. Cheers, Jerry.
Thanks a million. Cheers.
There, I hope you're enjoying the content delivered on the CPI podcast. Even though it's free to listen to, it actually takes quite a bit of time and financial commitment to deliver each and every episode. Did you know that by leaving a positive written review, you, yes, you, will have a direct impact on the visibility of the podcast? And that's really important, because by reaching a wider audience, it helps our team to continually improve the overall content that we deliver to you week after week. For some of you, leaving a review will be second nature, but for others, it might be your first one. Open your podcast app, pick the CPI podcast and search for previous reviews. And on iTunes in particular, click to look at all of the reviews and then you'll see an option to leave a written review. Go on, it'll only take 2 minutes and it'll really make our day. And we genuinely read every single one of them.